Thank you, Alvin. Good morning. I'm not used to such a big crowd. When we had the first song, I got to looking over this audience, this congregation. And the people we spent about 3 weeks with here in February and March would be about what's over here on this side of the room, to kind of give you an idea. And most of those people have never been in a church, and they're our brothers and sisters. 16 of them have a church in Emmett, Idaho. Brother Roy Kuhn is the elder there. And they consider themselves very fortunate, which they are, that they have the chance to meet together. Sister Mary Kuhn in Green River, Wyoming, is by herself. And she always has been. And that's hard for me to understand, because I'm used to here. You're used to here. Brother and Sister Riley up in Columbia Falls, Montana, and Sister Evelyn York, they had a local up there once, and it has dwindled to where there's only three people up there now. So they had an idea of what it's like for fellowship. We've got maybe 50 to 60 people up there in the Northwest. Most of them have never been inside a church of Christ. And some of them are second and third generation members. Now, we have problems trying to keep ourselves on our straight and narrow, clinging to the rotted iron like the young folks were demonstrating up here with their presentation. We as a individually here, or we as a group, with what we're used to, we have trouble. Can you imagine the struggle that those people have? I'm in constant admiration of them for their dedication. They may get off on tangents now and then, but you can't blame them, because they don't have Sunday school classes like we have. They don't have fellowship like we have. They don't have study groups like we have. They don't have, some of them don't even have anybody to talk to about the gospel, about the fullness of the gospel. The first time we went off up in there last summer, I think the one statement that just really got me, and I heard it more in one place, because they were kind of surprised when we came through in June, because they have church in October. And I'm thinking, my word, I have church on Sunday morning and Sunday night and Wednesday night. And they have church in October. And it makes you really want to cry. Because you know what it takes to feed you spiritually. And you know what your commitment has to be to come in here and be strengthened, be admonished, be instructed, be comforted. Any of those things that you want to call for a descriptor on those, and you would be amazed at our brothers and sisters that don't have that. They don't have that, and really it's a treasure for us. With many of them, you got to start at the beginning, every time. And in many places, you don't start by reading them what they should be doing out of the scriptures. You start by getting their credibility. You start by seeing if you're truthful, if you're circumspect, if you're sober in thought, if you have common sense. And only then will they start believing what you tell them about our religion. And sometimes that takes two or three visits, sometimes more. I'm going to begin with an opening text today in the third book of Nephi in chapter 5. And I'm going to read to you what Christ first began with when he came to this continent. And I'm going to start with verse 12. I'm going to read verse 12 first. This is Christ speaking. I'm going to start in verse 11. Behold, I am Jesus Christ, of which the prophets testified should come into the world. And behold, I am the light and the life of the world. And I have drunk out of that bitter cup which the Father hath given me, and have glorified the Father in taking upon me the sins of the world, in the which I have suffered the will of the Father in all things from the beginning. You know, there's sermons in that short little passage right there about the bitter cup that he had to partake of, the temptations that he endured, all the suffering, including he suffered the will of the Father in all things. You know, those are nice little words. That's a nice sentence. That's a nice passage. But what does it really mean to the welfare of your soul? What is Christ saying that he's endured for us there? What did he endure for us? You know, he didn't come down here just to go through a little scenario of things and acts and occasions and occurrences and sayings and then go back to his Father in heaven. He came down here to submit himself to the same temptations that you and I are submitted to daily. Same temptations, same emotions, same buffetings that we get, you know, with our emotions and everything. And then he showed us how to react to them. And he showed us how to perceive them. He showed us how to handle them. He showed us how to stay away from things. He showed us how to love people. He showed us how to recognize what's of him and what's not of him. And I think a lot of that is encompassed in that verse and a half there. That we read and we accept and we think that's real nice and good, but do we understand what it really tells us? I'm going to go over to verse 21. And the Lord said unto him, I give unto you power that ye shall baptize this people, and when I am again ascended into heaven. And again the Lord called others and said unto them likewise, and he gave unto them power to baptize. And he saith unto them, on this wise shall ye baptize, and there shall be no disputations among you. Verily I say unto you, that whoso repenteth of his sins through your words, and desireth to be baptized in my name, on this wise shall ye baptize them. Behold, ye shall go down and stand in the water, and in my name ye shall baptize them. And now behold, these are the words which ye shall say, calling them by name, saying, Heaven authority giving me of Jesus Christ, I baptize you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. And then shall ye immerse them in the water, and come forth again out of the water. And after this manner shall ye baptize in my name. For behold, verily I say unto you, that the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost are one. And I am in the Father, and the Father in me, and the Father and I are one. And according as I have commanded you, thus shall ye baptize. And there shall be no disputations among you as there hath hitherto been, neither shall there be disputations among you concerning the points of my doctrine as there hath hitherto been. For verily, verily, I say unto you, that he that hath the spirit of contention is not of me, but is of the devil, which is the father of contention. And he stirreth up the hearts of men to contend with anger one with another. Behold, this is not my doctrine, to stir up the hearts of men with anger one against another, but this is my doctrine, that such things should be done away. Behold, verily, verily, I say unto you, I will declare unto you my doctrine, and this is my doctrine, and it is the doctrine which your Father hath given unto me. And I can go on for several pages. But that's how he began his ministry on this continent. And those are the points that he made to begin with. And we know after he first went in, left the people that first day, and then when he came back, he found his disciples preaching what he told them, quote, nothing varying from what they had been told. Well, where am I going with this? In our travels, I have found one of the worst things I can do is when somebody asks me a question, I can just give them an answer. I have found it very beneficial to say, let's go look it up. I believe I got that from Brother Marvin Case. But the first thing you got to do is get them convinced that the Bible and the Book of Mormon are true, even though some of them have believed it all their lives, they say. And many times when you start into the Bible and the Book of Mormon, they'll haul out another book or some commentary and say, well, this says this. And I say, yeah, and it's commentary. Let's go see what it says in the Bible and the Book of Mormon, because I didn't write those. I just believe in them. There's been times in journeys that I've been called a Protestant because I believe that there's a heaven and a hell. And there's times that I've been called an idiot by a Protestant because I believe in a heaven and a hell. And it's because of what they want to believe, not what they're supposed to believe. It's because of what their traditions are. It's because of what maybe their families have taught them, maybe their friends have taught them, whoever that's led them down their doctrinal path has taught them, or they've just come up with it. And I believe the Bible and the Book of Mormon tell me that there is a heaven and a hell. There's a right and a wrong. There's actions and there's consequences. And it says it a couple of hundred times, really. So when you have a difference of opinion, some of them get mad. Completely forget what I just read there about the spirit of contention. I'd like to see you talk the gospel of Christ and get mad. Because when you get mad, you're talking under the spirit of the devil. And it's that simple. So you continue to talk? No, you stop and you get rid of that spirit. It's that simple. But these are what I've been told. Well, those are just the basics. Let's talk about some meat. And I said, we'll talk about the meat when we can talk using the basics. How often do we do that? When we associate with one another socially, do we do it without envy? Do we do it without power plays? Do we do it without trying to get the upper hand? Do we like to argue? Do we like to bait people and get them mad? I think that's especially back there on page 632 when I was reading there in verse 11 and 12. When I got to reading that, I went back to what Christ had to put up with in the Mideast in the Bible. And you know, we talk a lot about doctrinal dissension and differences of opinion and doctrine and things like that today. And we'd sure like for it to be like it is in the New Testament, where, you know, Christ was here and he could set everybody straight. But if you look in the New Testament, the whole thing's about doctrinal dissension. The whole thing's about Jesus Christ coming with his gospel and trying to show the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, and all of these people that they're thinking wrong. And they got it all wrong. And they get mad at him for it. I'm going to read you a couple of passages, and they're familiar passages, but I want to show you what Christ had to put up with as far as doctrinal dissension. I'm going to start in Matthew, 15th chapter. First verse, then came to Jesus, scribes and Pharisees, which were of Jerusalem, saying, Why do thy disciples transgress the traditions of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread. But he answered and said unto them, why do you also transgress the commandments of God by your traditions? Turned it right around on them. For God commanded, saying, honor thy father and mother, and he that curseth father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, whosoever shall say to his father or his mother, it is a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, and honor not his father or mother, he shall be free. Thus ye have made the commandment of God of none effect by your tradition. Ye hypocrites, well did Elias prophesy of you, saying, this people draweth nigh unto me with their mouth, and honoreth me with their lips, but their hearts is far from me. But in vain they do worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of man. And what was their reaction to that? It's the same reaction we get when you go down with a group of people that are studying, and you say, well, now this is what it says here. And they say, that's a bunch of hogwash. We know better than that. It's the same thing as me being called a Protestant because I believe that there's a heaven and a hell, because that's what the scriptures tell me. It's the same mindset. Go over to the 23rd chapter. He's a little more pointed here. Then spake Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. But do not ye after their works, for they say and do not. For they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments, and love the uppermost rooms for feasts, at feasts, and the chief seats in the synagogues, and greetings in the markets, and to be called of men Rabbi, Rabbi. And he covers several subjects on down through the remainder of that chapter, and keeps talking about, oh, woe to the scribes and the Pharisees. These were the religious pillars of the day. These were the people that had been looked up to for thousands of years, really. What were they doing wrong? Why did he come down on them so hard? I mean, they were teaching of God, and he believes in God. What's the difference? Well, it's the same thing where people call me a Protestant because I believe in a heaven and a hell. It's the same mindset. They may read what's there, but they don't believe it, and they don't look at it that way. They believe what they want to believe because of tradition, or because it's not comfortable for them, or because they don't think that's the way it should be because it doesn't sound right to them. The Sabbath was instituted in Genesis, 2nd chapter, 3rd verse. That's when the first reference was made anyway. Well, the Sabbath was really instituted in chapter 16 of Exodus, verses 22 to 26, but it started because of that reference to Genesis 2:3. And I'm going to read it. Then I'm going to read something else that happened. And I'm in Exodus 16. And it came to pass that on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread and two omers for one man, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. This is Moses. And he said unto them, this is that which the Lord hath said, tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that which ye will bake today, and seeth that ye will seeth, and that which remaineth over lay up for you to be kept until morning. And they laid it up until the morning, as Moses bade. That was Moses telling them this now. And it did not stink. Of course, you're talking about manna. Neither was there any worm therein. And Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath day unto the Lord. Today ye shall not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, in it there shall be none. That's about the first reference to the Sabbath. Now I'm going to go to Deuteronomy, and I'm going to start in the 12th chapter, or 5th chapter, 12th verse. And this is only about 40 years later. Now this is what Moses is teaching about the Sabbath. Keep the Sabbath day to sanctify it as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. 6 days thou shalt labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord God, the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor any of thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou. And remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. What did he tie in there? He started off with a simple commandment, and he tied in the Exodus of Egypt. It says right there in verse 15, and I'm going to read it again. And remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day. He changed it. He changed it just like he did in another incident in Numbers. And this is in Numbers chapter 19, and I'm going to start with verse 7. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, take the rod, and gather thou the assembly together, thou and Aaron thy brother, and speak ye into the rock before their eyes, and it shall give forth his water. Remember, speak. Speak ye into the rock before their eyes, and it shall give forth his water. And thou shalt bring forth to them water out of the rock, so thou shalt give up the congregation and their beasts drink. Thou shalt give the congregation and their beasts drink. And Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock, and he said unto them, hear now, ye rebels, we must fetch you water out of the rock. And Moses lifted up his hand, and with his rod he smote the rock twice, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank, and their beast also. That's a pretty well-known incident of Moses not obeying the Lord. This is Moses. And I'll tell you where that leads, that kind of a mindset. Remember when I talked about when the disciples were teaching and preaching to the multitude just before Jesus made his second appearance here on this land, and he spoke to them nothing varying from what they'd been taught. That's two big words, nothing varying. I'm going to go back to the time in Matthew when Christ was dealing with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And I got to looking up what the Pharisees were, what the Sadducees were. And the one that articulated it the best is the Smith's Bible Dictionary. I looked it up in Vines, and I looked up definitions and stuff in Strong's, and none of them really disagreed, but the best description, the most descriptive thing was in Smith. So I'm going to read you what a Pharisee is. Pharisees were a religious party or school among the Jews at the time of Christ, so called from parishion, which is the Aramaic form of the Hebrew word, which means separated. So a Pharisee was someone that was separated. The chief sects among the Jews were the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes, who may be described respectively as the formalists, the freethinkers, and the Puritans. So if you were a Pharisee, you were a formalist. If you were a Sadducee, you were a freethinker. And if you were an Essene, you were a Puritan. A knowledge of the opinion and practices of the Pharisees at the time of Christ is of great importance for entering deeply into the genius of the Christian religion. A cursory perusal of the Gospels is sufficient to show that Christ's teaching was in some respects thoroughly antagonistic to theirs. And many times he denounced them in the bitterest of language. And I've already read some of it, like in the 23rd and the 15th chapter of Matthew. To understand the Pharisees is by contrast an aid towards understanding the spirit of uncorrupted Christianity. And I think that's probably the one statement right there is why I decided to read this. The fundamental principle of the Pharisees, common to them with all Orthodox modern Jews, in other words, they still believe it to this day, is that by the side of the written law, to us it's the Bible and the Book of Mormon, by the side of the written law, regarded as a summary of the principles and general laws of the Hebrew people, there was an oral law to complete and explain the written law. And I've got a book at home that's about that thick. They're supposed to tell them what the first five chapters of the Old Testament mean. It was an oral law to complete and explain the written law given to Moses on Mount Sinai and transmitted by him through word of mouth, which is the first portion of the Talmud, which is another Jewish book, on the oral law. It is a digest of the Jewish traditions and a compendium of the whole ritual law, and it came at length to be esteemed far above the sacred text. In other words, by the time that they got done with this thing, the oral law took precedence over the first five books of the Old Testament. I have been told by a guy that I used to work with that belonged to the LDS Church. He kept coming into me in my office when he found out what church I belonged to, and he kept bringing in the Doctrine and Covenants. And he'd say, look at this, look at this, look at this. You know, just day after day, for a long time he did this. So finally one day I says, Miller, don't you ever read the Bible in the Book of Mormon? And he just scowled at me and he said, what do I need that for? He says, I got this. He said, you don't need anything else. That's exactly what they're talking about right here. I just read it. That their oral law, their description of what it meant, their commentary, took precedence over the written law. While it was the aim of Jesus to call men to the law of God itself as the supreme guide of life, the Pharisees, upon the pretense of maintaining it intact, multiplied minute precepts and distinctions to such an extent that the whole life of the Israelite was hemmed in and burdened on every side by instructions so numerous and trifling that the law was almost, if not wholly, lost sight of. They made it so complicated you couldn't do it all, is what they're saying. They made it so complete you couldn't do anything in your life today without having to follow a particular ritual. These traditions, as they were called, had long been gradually accumulating, so they didn't get them all at once. And that's a good warning sign for us. They didn't get them all at once. They got them a piece at a time over generations, because they decided that they could improve on it, or they thought they knew a better way. Such were their washings before they could eat bread, and the special minuteness with which the forms of this washing were prescribed for their bathing, when they returned from the market, their washing of cups, pots, and brazen vessels, their fasting twice in the week, and their tithing, and such finally that those minute and vexations, extensions of the law of the Sabbath, which must have converted God's gracious ordinance of the Sabbath rest into a burden and a pain. And that's one of the things that there in the 15th chapter of Matthew that Christ was trying to tell them. You have made this Sabbath such a burden and a pain with all of your ceremonies and your rites and all of these things that you have to do to observe the Sabbath that you've forgotten what it means. It was the leading aim of the Redeemer to teach men that true piety consists not in form, but in substance. Big difference. One's external, one's internal. not in outward observances, but in an inward spirit. The whole system of Pharisaic piety led to exactly opposite conclusions. The lowliness of piety was, according to the teaching of Jesus, an inseparable commitment of its reality. But the Pharisees sought mainly to attract the attention and to incite the admiration of men. Indeed, the whole spirit of their religion was summed up not in confession of sin and in humility, but in a proud self-righteousness at variance with any true conception of man's relation to either God or his fellow creatures. It became its own beast. There was no broken heart and contrite spirit. Everything that they did was a ceremony, was rote. It really was rote. With all their pretenses to piety, they were in reality, well, I can't say that word, greedy, I'll use greedy, greedy, sensual, and desolate. They looked with contempt upon every nation but their own. Sound familiar? Whenever you meet someone of a different denomination. Finally, instead of endeavoring to fulfill the great end of the dispensation whose truths they profess to teach, and thus bringing men to the hope of Israel, they devoted their energies to making converts to their own narrow views, who with all the zeal of proselytes were more exclusive and more bitterly opposed to the truth than they were themselves. And that's backed up by Scripture. So their religion was one of narrowness and bitterness and rigidity and had no feeling in it. And it does just what happens when men leave the gospel of Christ out of their lives. They become. That's what he gave us for a religion. Well, there's a lot of difference in what I just read and what I read there at the first and third in the third book of Nephi. Behold, I am Jesus Christ, of which the prophets testified, should come into the world. And I am the light and the life of the world. And I have drunk out of that bitter cup which your Father hath given me, and have glorified the Father in taking upon me the sins of the world, in which I have suffered the will of the Father in all things from the beginning. He didn't say, I won, I overpowered, it was me, I did it, and I showed him who was wrong. He didn't say that. My answer to me being accused of being a Protestant was I read him out of Alma. And I'm going to make a guess and say it was the 19th chapter, I think. I'm pretty sure it was. Because I could have very quickly degenerated into a shouting match. Because they were mad at me. Because they had it all in their head, how heaven and hell were, and how their sons and daughters or their relatives or their friends were not going to be punished because they didn't believe like they did. And they were just going to, you know, be it a little. They were going to be chastised a little bit, but that was it. But nobody goes to hell. It's a nice, comfortable, fuzzy feeling, if that's what you want to believe. We can get wrapped up very, very easily in that same mindset to where everything's a ceremony, everything's a, quote, belief. We can get all wrapped up in form, making our religion a form. We recite things that we say we believe. And we don't have to do anything else, and we can belittle those who don't agree with us. And we can figure out cute ways of putting them down. We can get all of our scriptural hand grenades to lob over into the other trench. However you want to say it. And it doesn't work. You're not serving the Lord when you do that. If you go to James, it tells you in James what religion is. First chapter, 37th verse. We all read it. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their afflictions and to keep himself unspotted from the world. My biggest problem is keeping myself unspotted from the world, because I can let egotism or pride or anger or variance or one-upmanship get into my soul, and boy, it can just do all kinds of damage. I can belittle and insult and bait just because somebody doesn't think like I do. And I can get them cleared off of the fact that they're thinking, maybe. And I've quit thinking because now I'm reacting. I got this in an email, and I don't know how far it went. But it was a little account of someone that wanted God to show them what heaven and hell were. And if you've already heard it, please bear with me. So God took them to hell first, and he took them into a room, and there was a whole bunch of people sitting around this big pot full of stew. And they all had these great big old long spoons. And they're all starving to death. And they're all trying to get this spoon in the pot and get the food in their mouth, and they can't do it because the spoon's too long. And they're all starving to death. And the person says, "This is hell?" And the guy, and God says, "Yeah." He says, "Well, what's heaven look like?" He went to another room, and here's the same amount of people sitting around the same kind of pot with the same stew in it, and they all had the same long spoons, and they're all happy and well-fed. He says, "What's the difference?" He says, "Watch them." And they're taking these big old long spoons, and they're dipping the pot, and they're feeding the other guy. If we have credibility, you're going to feed the other person. You're going to prefer your brother to yourself. You're not going to read the scriptures so you can be comfortable. You're not going to read the scriptures so you can say, "Aha, I told you so." You're not going to read the scriptures to get an edge on your brother. You're going to read the scriptures so you can learn how to feed him with your long spoon. Because the next thing he'll do, then he'll feed you. We don't read the scriptures to have just a list of doctrines. Our doctrine should be love thy brother as thyself. Love thy neighbor as thyself. I think it's what it says. Of course, I've been forced into reading the outline history of the church several times and to try to answer questions about what's happened in the past within this church. And the one thing that I've noticed in there, that whenever we have an influx of, I guess you'd say, traditional beliefs into the church, we end up arguing and splitting and fighting. And we get smaller. But whenever those things are done away with and we go back and we humble ourselves and we read what's in the Bible in the Book of Mormon and we do what it says and we don't invent things so we can improve upon it, but we just do what it says, we grow. At this point, we're starting to learn not to fight. And I'm going to say it that way. I think we're starting to learn what a broken heart and a contrite spirit are. It's the only way you get people to listen to you. You can browbeat them. You can outmaneuver them. You can wow them. You can go out and do all of these things, and when you're done, they remember that you outmaneuvered them, or that you browbeat them, or that you wowed them. And they don't remember a whole lot of what you talked about. You have to get their credibility first. The things that, like Brother Gary has with this session that we have, it started when it was the last Sunday night, wasn't it? It's wonderful. I believe those things should go on and on and on, and there should be some pretty embarrassing, hard, stiff questions asked so we can go to the answers. And we get the answers out of the scriptures, not out of our heads. Because that's what the scriptures are for, is to teach us. Our logic is not to teach us. Our own sense of wisdom is not to teach us. Our wisdom should be we go get it out of the Bible and the Book of Mormon. If you take a look around you this morning, there's an awful lot of people here. Now, you all may be used to this many people, but from other locals and from other areas in this country, there's an awful lot of people here. We're not down to two people because of a feud. We're up to, 125 people maybe here this morning because of love. And because maybe we're learning to use our big long spoons to feed each other, which should be our primary goal. And when we do that, then we should give Christ the glory for providing the stew. Thank you.